You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
That's right, we're talking the legacy of colonialism with cannabis here on the Tuesday Wire edition. I spoke with the creator, cultivator and curator of New Zealand's Cannabis Museum in Whakamana, Abe Gray. I started off by asking him, is there a strong relationship between colonial endeavours and some dank kush?
The biggest connection would be with the use of hemp for the rigging and sails of naval ships. So around that colonial period, the Western powers, you know, Spain, Portugal, the UK, the Netherlands, were all sort of competing for naval supremacy. And that kind of depended on the size of their armada of warships. And, you know, one wooden warship back in those times, we're talking 15, 16, 1700s, required some insane amount of tonnage of hemp twice a year to completely replace all the ropes and all the sails on a massive ship. And so if you're a, you know, an empire maintaining an armada of hundreds of ships, then you need a vast acreage of hemp to actually produce the raw materials to keep your naval fleet going. And so a lot of the wars of the 17 and 1800s were actually fought over access to that sort of land for cultivating hemp.
At the time, where was the majority of this hemp being produced?
The Russian Empire essentially had a monopoly on it, and that made them very geopolitically powerful. And so the British Empire was always trying to find alternative sources, and the driver for colonization in the Pacific was actually breaking that sort of Russian monopoly on hemp. And the idea of Australia being used as a penal colony has actually been exposed by some academics as really a cover story to try to divert attention from the fact that they were going there to try to grow hemp outside of the purview of the Russians. And in the course of that, they also came across New Zealand, and they discovered the Maori use of harakeke, and that it was, you know, of similar quality to hemp for ropes and sails. And of course, the Maori mariners managed to go all around the Pacific back and forth using those type of cordage materials. So when the British colonists came to New Zealand and they saw the New Zealand flax, they reported straight back that this could be a strategic alternative source of cordage besides cannabis hemp. And that's what kind of made New Zealand a strategic colony, and all the flax milling that started early on in colonial history was because of that.
So the relationship then from hemp to marijuana, how has that followed colonial legacies around the globe?
Well, so hemp is just cannabis plants with no THC in them, according to the New Zealand legal definition. But hemp is just the stems of the plant and the seeds of the plant being used for industrial purposes. So plants that contain THC can still have rope made out of them. It's just kind of a legal connotation of today that we think of it as having no THC. But so, you know, there was different uses for cannabis. There was the industrial uses, e.g. hemp, and then the, you know, recreational, religious, spiritual uses of the actual drug variety. And that was different in different cultures. The drug access to the drug variety was kind of suppressed by religious hierarchies in the West, especially throughout the Dark Ages. But in Eastern cultures, there wasn't such a prohibition, and so drug cannabis was used as a relaxing intoxicant, by say Chinese or Indian, especially seafarers. And we know that in the early days of New Zealand, especially, post-discovery pre-colonial, post-European discovery pre-colonial, most of the non-Maori inhabiting New Zealand were whaling and sealing gangs. And a lot of them were made up of merchant seamen from India, from China. Many of them had sort of been press-ganged into labor. But, you know, when you've got a hard life aboard an old ship in the 1800s, and you just got to, you know, go kill seals all day in some strange country. If you're coming over from India, certainly you would have brought seeds of the drug cannabis with you. You would have planted it as soon as you hit land, and you would have had a stash to basically get you through, whereas the European sailors were probably more drinking alcohol.
So pre-colonial times, people arriving were developing their own stash. But when the colonialists did arrive, how did that relationship between cannabis and the growing New Zealand community and the indigenous inhabitants, the Māori. How did that change?
As soon as the Western colonies became firmly established in New Zealand, large plantations of cannabis were established immediately for the industrial uses of hemp because, you know, they had to fit out the ships that were going to be based in New Zealand. But the drug varieties, as I say, would have also been known to a select group. You know, those Eastern seafarers had often, you know, in the 1820s and 30s, in some cases, had married into the local Maori, and they would have sort of exchanged traditions. So use of drug variety cannabis was probably known on land in New Zealand from, say, the 1820s. Large-scale cultivation for industrial purposes would have started off in earnest in the 1850s and 60s. And there's herbarium specimens in the National Herbarium, which is like a library of historical plant specimens at Lincoln University, of cannabis plants going all the way back to the 1840s, all over New Zealand. But the wider sort of use of it as a medicine really came into focus at the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, surrounding a woman called Mary Joseph Aubert, or Suzanne Aubert, and then later Mother Mary Joseph. She was like a Catholic nun, and she's actually about to become New Zealand's first Catholic saint.
New Zealand's first Catholic saint, Mary Joseph, the saint of Mary Jane.
Yes, exactly. And she was a nurse in the Crimean War. And when she came to New Zealand, she brought all the sort of cutting-edge medical knowledge of the day with her. And in the late 1800s, that was all sort of herbal medicines and tinctures and stuff. That's how pharmacies were operating still. And when she came, she was one of the first people to become fluent in Maori. She was one of the first Europeans to move into the interior of the North Island. And she translated a lot of English and French texts into Maori and wrote down a lot of sort of Maori oral traditions in English and French. And she took her herbal medicine practice amongst the Maori, eventually settling in what's now known as Jerusalem in the Whanganui River. She established that sort of convent there. And she actually learned from the local Maori about their herbal medicine traditions of the local Rongoa and combined that with her knowledge of European herbal medicine, including cannabis, which was sort of at the top of the food chain in the pharmacopoeia at that time, prior to Prohibition. So she actually combined things like kawakawa and cannabis to make unique New Zealand herbal medicines, and they were really popular. And in fact, they were sought to be commercialized by a Dunedin pharmaceutical company, and because of some unscrupulous practices, including watering down the medicines, Mother Mary became incensed and burned all of her original recipes, and a lot of the her role in cannabis medicine in those early days has kind of been suppressed, and the Catholic Order, the Sisters of Compassion, consider it a very sensitive topic at this time that they're trying to get her through to final sainthood, so I wouldn't be surprised if they're a bit cagey about that, but there's plenty of books referencing all of that.
So bringing it forward to the modern day, I'm interested to find out how this, as you said, this idea of Western suppression of marijuana as a recreational drug, how has that influenced modern day society, especially in relation to things like disproportionate prison rates?
Well, I mean, the idea of drug laws was always rooted in racism. It goes back to the same time period, late 1800s, early 1900s, with the opium laws that were created to essentially discriminate against Chinese. And in the same way, cannabis was prohibited, especially in the Indian British colonies and also in North America, based on racism against brown people. In India, it was against the local Indians. In North America, it was against African Americans and Hispanics.
And do you think we see the legacy of that surviving today?
Well, yes, we do. I mean, see, the modern drug war never really came to New Zealand until the 1960s, but ever since it started in earnest, back with the opium laws and then with the cannabis prohibition laws, it was always just a tool to justify racism. Basically, when overt racism went out of fashion, they had to come up with other reasons. And that racism didn't just extend to people of color. It also was, you know, not just race, but also counterculture. And so in the time of the Vietnam War, there was, you know, a big sentiment in the government against protesters and hippies. And yeah, so the drug war was just sort of reinvigorated as another excuse back in the 60s to go after hippies and anti-war protesters. And that's kind of when it came to New Zealand. It was in the milieu of sort of rising youth political activity, anti-Vietnam War protests, and a hotbed of youth political activity in the late 60s that we first saw prohibition come into New Zealand. And initially it was only supposed to be an interim experiment that was reviewed after a couple of years, and unfortunately that never happened.
Finally, I just wanted to ask, with the changing rhetoric around drug laws in New Zealand that we're sort of moving through at the moment, do you think that in the near future we will sort of come out the other side of this colonial legacy relation to our drug laws? Or do you think that the reforms needed to sort of, I suppose, make up for this seemingly discriminate style of law will take more than the generation that is currently facing the brunt of those laws?
Ending the drug war tomorrow is not going to end colonialism, but it will make a big difference. Some of the most egregious side effects of colonization will be lessened. And, you know, the making excuses for colonization is really what the drug war is all about. So if you can label people as druggies and other and dehumanize them in the mind of the public, then basically it's okay to persecute them and take away their human rights through the drug war. By removing that, it'll be one less excuse to mete out colonization against anyone, but that's not going to take it away, and we still have to call it out when we see it.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.